will talk with a criminal law professor this hour who doesn't think the punishment fits the crime in this country. Says the worst of the worst in our country's prisons are not really being punished as they should. They're being treated essentially the same as those who have committed less heinous crimes. Does our criminal justice system deal with criminal offenders in a just manner? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. That's one of the questions that we will be examining this hour as we talk with the author of The Death of Punishment. 1-800-642-1234 is the number you can call if you have a view or a question about this. Do you think that criminal offenders are punished enough? Why or why not? Do you support the death penalty? Why or why not? What reforms would you recommend for our criminal justice system? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Robert Blecker, professor at New York Law School, former anti-corruption prosecutor as a special assistant attorney general for New York. He is considered an expert on the death penalty, and he is the author of The Death of Punishment, Searching for Justice Among the Worst of the Worst. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
So who are the worst of the worst?
Well, the worst of the worst are sadistic serial killers. They are those who rape, then torture and kill children or adults. They are hired killers. They are terrorists. We can identify them in advance, essentially, not precisely, but essentially.
Yeah, and your thought is that we're not punishing these worst of the worst the way we should.
Well, we seem to be committed, at least we say we are, to having the punishment fit the crime. And if we are, and we've been saying this for centuries, and if we are really committed to that essential proposition of justice, that the punishment should fit the crime, then those who commit the worst crime should receive the most severe punishment. But when you go inside prisons, and I've spent thousands of hours inside maximum security prisons and on death rows in seven states over the last 25 years, interviewing convicted killers and the officers who guard them, when you go in, you find something that's very different from the credo that we mouth. What you find is that there is a consistent view among both the prisoners and the guards that the crime that a person commits outside in the street should have nothing to do with the quality of their lives inside prison, day to day. And that's remarkable when you think about it. And the whole structure of our prison system, I mean, if you look at the way we break down our prisons, we break them down into security levels, maximum security, typically medium security, and minimum security. And that's a function of how dangerous a person is once he's inside, the odds that he will escape, and the odds that he will attack fellow officers or fellow prisoners or visitors. But none of that has anything to do with the nature of the crime that he committed outside. So that, in a sense, to answer your question, we've completely severed the crime from the punishment. The only thing that reflects that in our criminal justice system is the length of the sentence, but not the quality of the time spent inside.
Yeah. So aren't the worst of the worst put in, the maximum security and sometimes even isolation? They don't even look at what the worst of the worst has done.
No, they really don't. In fact, those who are predators, the ones who, and predators on the vulnerable, they prey on the elderly, they prey on children, they're of course cowards. And once they're captured and confronted with overwhelming power, state power, they become pussycats. They become extraordinarily compliant and well-behaved inside prison. So they become model inmates. They become trustees. They sometimes, ironically, get the best jobs. They're in there for life. They consider the prison their home. They want everything to be kept calm. They're not going to be transferred. And so they are often given the best jobs and have the most perks. And that has nothing to do, of course, and it's directly antithetical with the nature of the crime that put them there. But be aware, this is only half of it, because the other half is just as distressing.
What's the other half?
Well, that those who commit the least serious crimes are given the problems in our criminal justice system, the mandatory minimum sentences, the three strikes and you're out, legislation that was enacted in the early 90s and still in effect in the federal system in many of the states. Often people have life without parole sentences for having committed nonviolent crimes, relatively trivial crimes, and they will be mixed in the same prison and given the same experience initially with the most vicious and sadistic criminals. And often because they will misbehave by possessing contraband or violating some other prison regulation, they're going to end up in what's called punitive segregation. And as its name suggests, that's punishment. But that punishment has nothing to do with the crime that they initially committed. It has to do with how they behave once they're inside. So as a society, we've completely severed the nature of the crime from the day-to-day experience of punishment.
Why do you think this has happened?
Well, it's happened for a number of reasons that have combined. One is that the public simply either assumes that life is very different. I mean, you hear it bandied about constantly by opponents of the death penalty. If you really want to punish them, send them to prison for life. Life without parole, that's a living hell. Life is worse than death. And the press and media, who are largely against the death penalty, abet that conception. That's one reason. A second reason on the part of the officers themselves as to why they administer this kind of quality of life that is fundamentally perverse and disconnected with the nature of the crime is that they're guided in part by their mission statements. And if you look at the mission statements of the Departments of Corrections in the United States, and I've read them all, and the federal government, you will not find the word punishment as any part of any mission of any Department of Corrections in the United States. Punishment is not our goal. It's not what we're about, they uniformly say to me. That's one part of it. And then another part of it is just human nature, which is they want to work in a relatively peaceful environment. They don't want to be watching their backs and worrying about whether they're going to be shivved by a prisoner, because weapons abound inside the prisons. They want to go home at night. And so they want to keep the prisons safe for everybody. They want to keep the environment calm and peaceful. And the best way to do that, of course, is to give the prisoners privileges. And the great threat is not that they will be punished, but that their privileges will be removed.
Well, what is the problem, Robert Becker, with the way it is now? If things are relatively, you know, safe and peaceful, and the worst of the worst are being kept away from society, they can't harm anybody, what's the problem?
Well, the problem is it's not justice. It's fundamentally unjust. You know, we tend to forget this. If you look at the United States Constitution, the famous preamble, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union," everyone remembers that. Almost everyone remembers general welfare and secure the blessings of liberty and provide for the common defense. But almost everyone forgets what the second purpose of the preamble of the United States Constitution is, and that's justice. It is fundamentally unjust when somebody has raped and murdered a child that he will find himself for the rest of his life waking up in the morning, turning on the radio, listening to some news, then watching TV and playing television quiz games, for example. I'm thinking of one particular guy talking about his daily routine, watching Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and trying to answer the questions, then going out to work in the kitchen, then coming back and taking a shower and watching, say, a Chicago Cubs game in the case of Illinois, or a football game, and hanging out with the guys. And it's a lifestyle that is fundamentally perverse when you realize that the victims are dead. And the victims have been, in some cases, murdered and mutilated and tortured. It's fundamentally unjust. Again, we return to it. Let the punishment fit the crime. Do we believe it? If we believe it, why don't we administer it?
We are talking with Robert Blecker. He is the author of The Death of Punishment, Searching for Justice Among the Worst of the Worst. Do you think that the punishment should fit the crime? What do you think about what our guest is saying, that the worst of the worst are not being punished the way they should? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with a law professor who says our prison system doesn't do enough to punish criminal offenders who have done or committed truly vicious murders. And we're talking about punishment and whether or not our criminal justice system is dealing with criminal offenders in a just manner. What do you think? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We have lots of callers, so let's go to Ray in Milwaukee. Hello, Ray.
I'm pretty disturbed by what the guest is saying so far, because what it sounds like to me is he's suggesting maybe we should torture these people or put them at hard labor. You know, I have no problem with them working and actually maybe bringing back some benefit to a society, which maybe they have taken away from. But have you considered the state of Illinois, which has released I don't know how many people off death row because they were tortured by the police into confessing? And are you also willing to torture white-collar criminals like these bankers who have robbed the country of trillions of dollars? Shouldn't they maybe be getting the hard labor, too?
Are you advocating torture of these criminal offenders, Robert Blecker?
No, I'm certainly not, but your caller's questions are provocative and they're good. Of course I'm not advocating torture. You can't advocate torture without being fundamentally inhumane and also violating the United States Constitution. The Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. And while there is some dispute as to the limits of cruel and unusual punishment, there's no dispute that the core of what was outlawed by the founding generation and remains consistently outlawed by this one and future generations, one assumes and hopes, is torture. No, I'm not advocating torture at all. As far as hard labor, and it would be nice, he says, if they were to contribute back to society. When you look at it in those terms, utilitarian terms, in terms of the future and what can they contribute, I mean, that's a legitimate perspective. It happens not to be mine. I'm actually bound by the past. I believe that we make covenants with the victims. And Adam Smith really did a brilliant job with this, famous for his Wealth of Nations, but more famous in his lifetime for a book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And it's a retributive psychology. And he says, imagine the victim looking down and seeing the daily life of the person who killed her. What would she say? How would she feel? I think that's a relevant question. And then finally, so hard labor is all about productivity. And people who oppose punishment often say and ask, and that's implicit in the question, what good will it do? But for us retributivists, that's not the key question. The key question is what bad has been done and what is deserved. And now the final part of the question was, would I also have these harsher punishments reserved for white-collar criminals? Well, I prefer to use the phrase in certain times of red-collar criminals, because I think sometimes white-collar is the wrong appellation. That is, those, for example, who maintain deadly workplaces and cut corners and don't worry about the fact that their employees are taking mercury baths or that they dump PCBs into streams and poison them and people come down with cancer. And they do this all for the best of motives, the profit motive. These are people whom this society underpunishes radically. We call it white collar. In my view, as I said, it should be called red collar. Would I more even out the system of justice? I absolutely would. When you have people who corporate executives who are maintaining deadly workplaces and making a carefully calculated decision to cut costs and risk and take the lives of their employees, that to me is a depraved indifference recklessness, which should constitute an adequate culpable mental state for the worst punishments that we have. So, yes, I understand the class bias, and the book goes into it very much. We've structured our death penalties with an extraordinary class bias, with using robbery as the aggravating circumstance that has put more people on death row than any other. And our assumption is that those who rob from a pecuniary motive thereby kill from a pecuniary motive, even though sometimes robberies simply go bad. And the killing may be accidental, but if it's in the course of and in furtherance of a robbery, it can get you life, and in some cases it can get you death. Whereas our white-collar criminals, with a more culpable mental state, who also cause the deaths of innocent people and sometimes many more, we don't reserve harsh punishments for. So I'm very sensitive to your caller's implicit attack and his being disturbed. But that's only because he only has heard part of it so far. This book calls for, on the basis of thousands of hours with killers and interviews over decades, this book calls for a more moral, a more discriminating, a more even-handed system of justice.
How do we decide the best course of action? What is that more even-handed justice?
Well, it would require doing several things. It would require, in those states that have the death penalty, and I do advocate for the death penalty for the worst of the worst of the worst, it would require a death penalty statute that is much more sensitive and is not so broadly brushstroked. It would also require one which is committed to making even more sure that we never execute the innocent. So it would require that we refine categories. First and foremost, we would drop the felony murder aggravating circumstance that has put more people on death row than any other. And then the book goes through it, and I put my money where my mouth is. I offer a refined death penalty statute, which is based upon, again, spending thousands of hours with killers to really determine, and partly from their perspective too, because murders, which even murderers say are bad killings, tend to be the worst of the worst of the worst. So that's one part of it. And then the other part of it is we've got to get rid of this insane legislation, which with this three strikes and you're out, and these mandatory minima in which we take people who are essentially sick or themselves vulnerable. The latest ACLU report, A Living Death, talks about this and profiles hundreds of these people, women, for example, whose abusive boyfriends turned them into drug mules, and they're carrying a suitcase under coercion, and the suitcase contains a quantity of drugs which puts them in prison for life without parole because they had no one to give up so that they couldn't cooperate. These people shouldn't be in prison for life without parole. So what's required is that we examine case by case our criminal justice system. We see who's on death row. We see who's been sentenced to life without parole. We go worst first in terms of execution. And for the least bad, we start commuting and releasing. So it's a call for justice. It's a call for discriminating, not discriminatory, but discriminating justice.
Michael in Appleton. Hello, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What is your thought or question?
Well, for me, it's sort of stunning to me that your guest is going from advocating the death penalty directly to quoting a study from the ACLU, because if I remember correctly, they're rather strongly against the death penalty. Sort of my main point is, I feel the guest is sort of advocating things going the wrong way. Incarceration is in itself a form of punishment, and if you look at the Constitution forbidding cruel and unusual punishment, it's been shown that solitary confinement, which is abused rampantly in this country's prison system, is a form of abuse. And if you look at other countries and the way they do rehabilitation, I think we should be going less for punishment and more for rehabilitation of criminals. I mean, you look at, I think it's, I can't remember which country offhand, but it's in Northern Europe. They give their prisoners very high degrees of freedom and in goals of rehabilitating them, and it works.
All right, Michael, what about the goal should be rehabilitation, not punishment, Robert Blecker?
Okay. A few things. The ACLU... he's correct. Michael's correct. The ACLU is against the death penalty. Actually, they go beyond that. They are against life without parole entirely. In terms of the abuse of solitary confinement, yes, it has been abused. It's been abused because people who don't deserve it are getting it, and people who do are not. But now, Joy, to get to your main point. Oh, by the way, one last thing. He mentions Northern Europe, Norway. Anders Breivik, you may recall recently, a couple of years ago, methodically killed 80 people. He was against Muslim immigration and attacked the youth wing of the party that supported greater immigration reform. He carefully and methodically hunted them down and murdered 80 youths. Anders Breivik, under the Norwegian criminal system, has a maximum sentence of 21 years in prison. Now, that's not bad enough. Not only is it only 4 months per victim, but the nature of his experience is such that because they don't think that he's safely among other inmates, because some of them may try to kill him, they have hired professional playmates. That's what they are, professional playmates to play with him so that he won't be lonely. This is what we're going towards. This is the European model. I was in Germany recently. In Germany, you work, and then you get unemployment insurance. I kid you not. And you get vacation days, so that when you decide to take your vacation, even if you're in prison for life, that means you just lie around, you don't have to do anything because you're taking your vacation. And you get unemployment insurance. And officers are supposed to knock before they enter a cell. Because the animating principle in these countries, as Germany calls it, is the principle of normalcy, which is that life on the outside should as nearly resemble life on the inside as possible. So your prison experience should be as much as possible like your daily experience outside. This is the rehabilitative model. Now, I'm all for rehabilitation. For those whom we will release, we have an obligation to prepare to become constructive, productive, educated, humane members of society. And there's much too little rehabilitation going on in the prisons. I'm well aware of that. I mean, in Lorton Prison, which I spent 12 years inside, over thousands of hours, the only program that they were exposed to, or almost the only program, was to make barbecue pits. And there's no demand for barbecue pits once they're released. So that's one half of it, which is that we are not rehabilitating adequately those whom we're going to release. But for those we're never going to release and never should release, for those whom we have made a covenant with the dead to punish and punish forever, those people we have an obligation to punish daily, to make their daily experience unpleasant. They should not be playing. You know, I was on Florida's death row, and I saw Danny Rowling. Danny Rowling was the ninja killer, and he dressed in all black, and he used to stalk co-eds at the University of Florida and break into their houses and then torture them and rape them and then stab them to death. And I saw Danny Rowling on Florida's death row. He's a hell of a volleyball player. Well, they finally executed him, and even the Miami Herald supported that one, although they're against the death penalty. But until that point, for 20 years, he's playing volleyball, he's playing chess, and I saw him lying in bed with his reading glasses perched on his nose, reading, and his reading light over his shoulder, just lying there, reading a good book, and something deep inside me, deep, 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 protested and said, "Why aren't you dead?"
We are talking with Robert Blecker. He is the author of The Death of Punishment, Searching for Justice Among the Worst of the Worst. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our next caller is Pat in Richland. Hello, Pat.
Well, hello, Joy, and thank you for the great program. I'm glad you have this caller or guest because I want him to reassure us out here that he supports the death penalty. Now, everybody is going to say that it's a laudable goal, valued goal, for society to become more civilized. And, of course, if your guests don't believe that, he can tell us because we can take the truth out here. My question, sir, is how – give us one little example, if you could, please, how having the death penalty is even a baby step toward a more civilized society. And thank you, sir.
Yeah, we have other comments. We have a tweet from David on Twitter who says the civilized world has abolished capital punishment. So how does that jive?
Yes, I mean you hear that a lot, that we should follow Europe's lead and we should be judged by the people whose values we claim to associate with, and why is it that the countries with the death penalty are ones whose values we abhor? And they point to people. Point to China, and they point to some of the Arab countries, et cetera, whereas Europe has abolished the death penalty. Well, when you look into it, you find that the truth is not quite so simple. Every country in Europe that abolished the death penalty abolished it in the teeth of overwhelming support for it. That is, the people of those countries did not abolish the death penalty. The elites of those countries abolished the death penalty. And in fact, if you look at recent public opinion polls, in many European countries, for example, Poland, support for the death penalty is close to 80%. Even in Great Britain today, after decades of shaming and being taught that the death penalty is uncivilized, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, It's been conceded in public debate among leading opponents of the death penalty that a majority of the Brits still support the death penalty. Nearly half the Canadians still support the death penalty. Over and over again, throughout Europe, the people of Europe continue to support the death penalty. The people of Australia do. Now, that's not uniformly true. The Italians do not support the death penalty any longer, and the Irish probably do not support the death penalty. But there remains a majority of support for the death penalty throughout Europe. So to the question of why are we the only, quote, civilized country with the death penalty, or you often hear it phrased, why are we are the only Western democracy with the death penalty? The truth is we are the only Western democracy that is acting like a Western democracy, where the people's point of view actually counts, where it's not the experts and the elites top-down telling the people exactly what their criminal justice system will be like. It's rather elected public officials responding to the moral understanding of the people that sometimes some people do in fact deserve to die.
Let's go to Mark now in Black River Falls. Hello, Mark.
Good morning. Thank you for your topic and your guest today. I serve in a prison as a volunteer from time to time, and historically the issue with inmates, you know, giving justice to those inmates that have perpetrated a crime on a child, let's say. Can your guest speak to that? And also, I disagree with the fact that, you know, we might be a civilized society when we've murdered 50 million of our own babies through legalized abortion.
That's a different topic, Mark. But what about he's been in a prison, and it's not a walk in the park, and inmates will sometimes kill other inmates.
Yes. Now, there still remains gang warfare in terms of members of gang against gang. But let's leave that aside. That's not rampant throughout the prison system, but it's common in some pockets. But let's talk about what Mark himself is talking about, which is, and what you reiterated, inmates giving justice. In the 1980s and 1990s, when things were at their absolute wildest inside the prisons and worst, anybody who went inside with a crime against children and a crime against women, especially rape, could expect to be preyed upon by their fellow prisoners. It was part of the ethos of the society within the prison that those people should be taken out. With the substitution of and the accretion of privileges inside prison, where guys stood to lose more and more and more by doing that, there came to be a transformed sense of justice within the prison, at least I've been to probably 20 prisons at this point over the last 25 years in seven states. And fairly uniformly, what I see and what I'm told is that it's been a changed ethos. Now, when a guy comes in for child molestation, or a guy comes in for child murder, or a guy comes in for rape, he will be ostracized. That is, you won't have much to do with him, and you'll be especially sensitive toward him, and if he opens up his mouth, he might get shivved. But the fact is, no longer do the guys think it as any part of their mission to do the justice that society refuses to do. And they've fairly uniformly said to me when I've probed that them on this very question, look, if society's not going to punish him, why should I? Well, I'm not going to risk my color television. I'm not going to risk my privileges. I'm not going to risk my life inside general population to take him out. If society's not going to do it, I'm not going to do it. So the classic case of the prisoners coming in and being preyed upon has radically changed overall.
We are talking with a criminal law professor who doesn't think the punishment fits the crime in this country and says that the worst of the worst in our country's prisons are not being punished as they should. And we wonder what you think, what questions you have. Robert Blecker is the author of The Death of Punishment, Searching for Justice Among the Worst of the Worst. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We are talking with Robert Blecker, the author of The Death of Punishment, Searching for Justice Among the Worst of the Worst. And our next caller is Eric in Endeavor. Hello, Eric.
Good morning, Joy. Hey, I'm not agreeing or disagreeing with this guy. I just noticed that his opinion on what people would want when they're dead or any victims of a crime, he's assuming that everybody's going to be super angry and want tortured justification. And a lot of people actually in the real world that are victims of crime forgive people, and they're not after, you know, just angry torture and horrible things for people. And secondly, recently he said something about the inmates are no longer stabbing everybody. It's another reason for that is because 2/3 of the inmate population are in there for drunk driving and for silly little stuff. They're all getting sent to prison, and you don't have a huge group of hardcore people in prison anymore.
All right, well, we don't want, not all victims of crime want revenge in the form of the death penalty, Robert Blecker?
Yes. First of all, Joy, you know, you use the word, and so many people do, use the word revenge. I'm not about revenge. I'm about retribution. And though they stem from a common source, which is the desire to inflict pain on those who inflict pain on us, they're not identical. Revenge is limitless, and revenge need not be appropriately directed. When someone does something to me and I take it out on the entire group of which he or she is a part, I'm engaging in revenge. I'm not engaging in retribution. Retribution is limited and proportional. But now getting back to the specific question of not every victim would want it. I couldn't agree more. In fact, the abolitionists, those who oppose the death penalty, have something that they call a declaration of life. And you sign it. It's a statement that says, if I am ever murdered, no matter what the circumstances, I do not want my killer to get the death penalty. So far, that has never been admitted in any court of law. And proponents of the death penalty scoff at it. And I think they're wrong. I think the declaration of life should be admissible. Look, if we had executed Gandhi's assassin, we would have profaned Gandhi's memory. He was a man who stood for nonviolence. He was against the death penalty. And so Eric is exactly right. It's not all victims who would want it, and the victims' voice should count. I would allow for testimony in death penalty cases in the penalty phase by the victim's survivors, the family and the friends, as to what the victim would have wanted. And if the victim was known as an opponent of the death penalty, then that should count. They should be given a voice, not a veto. There may be several victims, and the victims may disagree, and there may be other reasons, nevertheless, to go forward with it. But he's quite right. It is not uniform among victims, and it is not uniform among survivors. And the past counts, and it should count in both directions. Mm-hmm.
So are 2/3 of the inmates in prisons drunk drivers or other nonviolent offenders?
No. That vastly overstates it. But it is true that there are many too many people in prison who are essentially sick, not evil, but sick, and that we should be having treatment programs for them rather than punishments, that the war on drugs, but by the way, even that's indiscriminate, and the book goes through that. I've spent a lot of time among drug users and drug sellers, And it turns out that those libertarians who want to legalize all drugs, in my view, are making a mistake, because not all drugs are alike. Heroin is a very different drug than what the drug of choice was inside Lorton, which was Boat, which was marijuana soaked in PCP, which is a vicious drug and makes you feel both paranoid and omnipotent at the same time, so that everybody's out to get you and nobody can stop you. That's one kind of drug. That turns people into vicious, uncontrollable predators. And those people who sell it and deal in it, are committing a much more serious crime than those people who sell, for example, heroin or marijuana. Not all drugs are alike, and again, we need to be discriminating. But not two-thirds of people are in for drunk driving. And by the way, drunk driving, let's not forget, drunk driving can be a very serious crime. I mean, whole families have been wiped out by drunk drivers. Mm-hmm. And just because there's no intent to kill, if you know that you're about to go on the road, and you know that you're drinking, and you still do it, you are exhibiting a depraved indifference to human life, which is a very serious culpable mental state. So I wouldn't call that a trivial crime. But there are relatively trivial criminals who are getting life without parole, and it's fundamentally unjust.
You're not, though, advocating that even a repeat drunk driver who, let's say a repeat drunk driver does in a crash kill a family. Is that the worst of the worst?
No, let's imagine a person who has previously lost his license, knows that he's a drinker, is at a bar, is warned by a friend and colleague, hey, you know, you better not get on the road, you're drunk, and says, you're going to be drunk, he's sober now, and says, screw it, I don't care, and knowingly continues to drink, and then allows himself to become, in a sense, a two-ton deadly weapon, and then kills a family, I don't think that a life sentence is disproportionate to that.
Yeah, and so you are, though, thinking for the death penalty, the worst of the worst are first-degree murderers who there is absolutely no doubt that the murder was convicted by that person?
Well, not to be persnickety, but there's absolutely no doubt that the ceiling in the rooms that we all sit right now will not cave in and crush us. So the no-doubt rule, of course, is not workable. But something very close to that, I would change the burden of persuasion. Right now, the juries in the penalty phase, the death penalty cases, just have to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the person did it and that he qualifies or she qualifies for the death penalty. My view is that we should have a rule by which if you have what's called sometimes a residual doubt, a non-rational doubt, a doubt which you cannot give a reason for, but something in your gut just isn't sure, that should be enough to spare the person. The United States Supreme Court said that is not constitutionally mandated. And secondly, the jury should not only be told that they must be convinced of the guilt beyond any residual doubt, but they should also be told that they must be morally certain that he deserves it. So no residual doubt and proof to a moral certainty that the death penalty is deserved. Because in some instances of some guys that I've met, I feel certain that they deserve it. And that's a very carefully chosen phrase, feel certain, because it encompasses both the intuition of emotion, which is itself a lens through which we reach justice, as long as it's restricted and restrained emotion and informed emotion, and also the rationality, the certainty.
What about wrongful conviction, somebody convicted of a crime and they did not do it?
There are wrongful convictions. The studies differ. The one I trust the most says that in the modern era, since 1976, we have probably condemned to death 30 people who are factually innocent of the crime that they committed. Now, we do not know for certain or even nearly certain any single person who has been innocent whom we have executed in the modern era, although I suspect there probably have been some, very few, but some. But here's the point. I wheel a stroller down Broadway in New York with my beloved grandchildren in it. I could go on a side street, but for the sake of my convenience, I will take them and subject them to a minuscule possibility that a truck will jump the curb and kill these people whom I adore, these little ones whom I adore. I do it for my own convenience. If I'm willing to to subject to a tiny risk of death those whom I adore for the sake of convenience, then I am certainly going to be willing to subject to a tiny risk of an unjust death those whom I rightly detest for the sake of justice. We constantly take tiny risks with life and innocent life. The question is, are those risks worth taking? And if it turns out that the death penalty is, as it is in some cases, the only just response, then what we've got to do is construct a system of justice in which we minimize the probability and possibility of being wrong, but like everywhere else in life, we take the risks that we need to take for the greater goals that we want to accomplish.
Jeff in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like your guest to describe a day in the life of one of these people who doesn't qualify for the death penalty as he's described it, which is a really, as he's described, a pretty small percentage of our prison population. But one of these guys who's maybe killed somebody, felony murder, whatever, so not quite the worst of the worst, what's a day in the life look like for that guy that's different than what he gets now when he's got life in prison with no possibility of parole? What's going to be different for him in this just world that your guest is describing?
For only the worst of the worst of the worst, where there either is no death penalty or there is a life without parole that supplements a death penalty. By the way, only the worst of the worst of the worst should ever get life without parole. Everybody else we should hold out hope for, and that includes people who have committed manslaughter so that they have wrongly killed. For the worst of the worst of the worst, whether or not we have a death penalty, we should have what I call permanent punitive segregation, which is that life should be unpleasant. They should be eating Nutriloaf, which is a tasteless but nutritionally complete patty, so that they don't get the pleasures of good food and tasty food. They should be given exercise. Their lives should not be foreshortened. We shouldn't have a death penalty surreptitiously. If we're not going to do it officially, then we don't do it. But they should be allowed to exercise, but they should not be allowed to play. They should never have human contact. Now, that's for the worst of the worst. For everyone else, life in prison should not be a pleasant experience, but it should include human contact. You should be allowed to have contact visits. You should be allowed to have limited periods of recreation. You should be allowed to have commissary privileges. So life would be very different for those in prison for all but the worst of the worst of the worst crimes.
We had a Supermax prison in Wisconsin. It was called the Supermax until a lawsuit stopped that. They're often described as the place to put the worst of the worst. But Wisconsin's facility in Boscobel was the subject of a lawsuit. The ACLU said it was treating the prisoners in this maximum security Supermax prison inhumanely. I'm just wondering, are Supermax facilities, do they play a role in ensuring proper punishment?
Rarely, except when it's a punishment for something you've done once you're inside. They are often used to segregate vulnerable prisoners, that is, prisoners who have committed notorious crimes, prisoners who might be subject to retaliation. They're not serving the function. They were designed, again, think of the title, Supermax, Super Maximum Security. They are designed to make us secure, maximally secure. They are not designed to reflect the quality of life inside with the quality of the crime committed. They are future-oriented. That is, they are oriented to keeping us safe, keeping the prisoners safe from each other, keeping the public safe from the prisoners, keeping the officers and visitors safe from the prisoners. Safety, 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 threat, and future. But justice, for some of us, is about the past as well as the future. And the Supermax system is not designed to respond to the past.
Richard emails, does your guest believe that Jeffrey Dahmer's death in prison was a moral good? Dahmer was sentenced to life. Another inmate, or so the story goes, anonymously crushed Dahmer's skull in a weight room. Well, it wasn't that anonymous because that guy came forward. Was that, in your guest's view, a moral narrative?
Yes, it was illegal. and he should be tried for murder for doing it, for killing Dahmer. But how did I feel when I heard that Jeffrey Dahmer had been killed in prison? I was pleased. I felt that it was right, that the world was better off with him dead. I would have preferred that he had been executed, but I was glad that he was killed, though it was illegal and the person who did it should be prosecuted. The class of all legal acts and the class of all moral acts are not identical. They are overlapping, but they are not identical.
Bill in Lancaster is with us. Hello, Bill.
Hi. Yeah, we obviously have a fundamental problem with our criminal justice system. We have, I believe it's 750 prisoners per 100,000 population, which is head and shoulders above any other country in the world. So we do need to do something. I'm not sure if what your guest is speaking to is exactly what we need to do, but there's clearly a problem in this country. And I think part of the problem is that we have privatized the prison system. I mean, there are federal prisons and state prisons, but the private prisons, they don't have an incentive to get rid of the prisoners because they get paid for every prisoner that they have.
Well, I don't think we have any private prisons in Wisconsin, but is that a part of the problem, Robert Blecker?
Yes, it is. Bill is absolutely right. The United States Supreme Court and other courts have declared private prison systems constitutional. I fundamentally disagree. I think that prisons and punishment is essentially a job of the state, and that the idea of having for-profit prisons in which, just as Bill said, the incentive is efficiency, the incentive is to keep your costs down and to keep your profits up, and to keep as many prisoners as possible, keep the facilities full, run them as efficiently as possible, has nothing to do with justice. There is no incentive. There's no incentive to rehabilitate those who deserve to be rehabilitated. There's no incentive to punish those who deserve to be punished. For-profit prisons, in my view, are unconstitutional, and in any case, they are simply wrong.
Well, what is the most important single reform that you think the criminal justice can make right now to provide justice?
I think we should examine, Kate, and there are not that many, there are about 3,000 people who are on death row right now. I think we should examine them case by case and move forward with executions worst first, and under a reformed system, we should commute the sentences of the least bad. I think we should examine case by case, as the ACLU calls for, those who are serving life without parole for nonviolent crimes, and we should be pressuring our executives to commute those sentences best first. So that's how I would move forward. Take our 3,000 worst, or what look like our 3,000 worst, and really find the worst of them and get rid of them. And take our 3,000 least bad and find the least bad of them and free them.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy.
Robert Blecker is the author of The Death of Punishment, Searching for Justice Among the Worst of the Worst. Thanks to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this program. Thanks to Marika Suval for on-air production. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.